This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Forget the backpack. Forget the gloves. The real question of the Nancy Guthrie case is one nobody can answer yet. Why has a person who took her said absolutely nothing? It's assuming the ransom notes, the TMZ noise, we'll call it that to be nice, is all nothing. Why has a person who took her said absolutely nothing? No contact with the family, no demands, no negotiation, just 3 weeks of silence, 4 weeks now. The ransom notes are noise, opportunist, not the perpetrator. So what kind of mind takes an 84-year-old woman and then goes completely dark? That's what we're unpacking today with psychotherapist and author Siobhan Scott. Siobhan, as always, welcome. Let's dive into this angle of the conversation without all the noise of TMZ and this and that and nanos. When someone abducts a person and makes no attempt to leverage them, no communication, no demands, no engagement, what does that silence typically represent psychologically? Is this about control, shame, or something else entirely?
It's really hard to say. You know, we're all speculating, but it doesn't seem like, with no ransom demand at this point, it doesn't seem like perhaps there was ever meant to be that kind of leverage, that it was never about financial gain for them. And so then we get into what would other motivations be? And perhaps the simplest one is that she's not alive, and that the concealment of a body simply makes it hard to prosecute someone for murder if there's never a body found.
Does that then fall us into the territory of, I mean, you know, basically Occam's razor, the simplest thing is the obvious, like a B&E gone wrong, I don't want to be in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. If I had to make my best guess, that's the best I could come up with. You know, the B&E gone wrong. The other, which would be a less likely possibility, would be some kind of personal grievance against Nancy or the Guthrie family or against Savannah. And this is just some kind of act of twisted revenge. But I think the B&E gone wrong is probably the simplest and most apt possibility.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, let's keep examining it if maybe there's something else for the sake of the conversation. You got hostage situations. Communication is currency. This has never been like a hostage type situation, as people, you know, may have wanted to think we're going to get there. We're just waiting for that to begin. You have the hostage negotiation team standing by, and great, never utilized. But the communication is currency, typically, in that sort of a situation. It's how perpetrators get what they want. But this person has made no effort to extract anything. Not money, not concessions, nothing, not even a message of any sort. What does it mean if somebody takes a human being and treats them as though they have no transactional value at all?
Well, it sure shows a lack of empathy, but I think anytime you have somebody who's criminally motivated, you know, whatever their motivation is, they're going to break into a house. This is not a person that has a lot of empathy and compassion for other people. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that attempts by the family to stir up this sense of guilt or morality, I don't think that's going to work, because just by nature of the crime, this is not a person who's wired that way.
What does it tell about the person's psychology that there's been no bite even at the money yet? And it's interesting because Savannah just yesterday put out the message that, you know, there's $1 million up for grabs if we can figure out where she is. And there's caveats to it. You got to, you know, basically communicate through the FBI to get this information, give us this information. And, you know, we're going to figure out who you are. So it's not like the killer can go cash in. But whoever may know something may cash in. What does it say about the whole dichotomy of that ecosystem of who that person is and maybe someone around them, that even thus far, $200,000 hasn't done the job, at $1 million now for more than 48 hours and still nothing? What does that read into you as?
Well, whoever the primary perpetrator is probably not going to bite, probably not going to have a response to mm-hmm. that because they know they're going to be caught. Would anybody else come forward? Who knows? There may not be anybody else who mm-hmm. has any information, or people may actually be communicating in some way, and it may not be any useful information, and we're just not being told about it at this point. But it certainly can't hurt to do it. I understand their motivation for trying.
You know, people have leakage. People do talk, but not always. And especially, you know, people hold deep, dark secrets, whatever. I doubt there's any stats on this. So I'm just going to go, you know, what's your insight on this? Of someone who does something like this, someone who's, let's say it is a B&E gone wrong, and let's say Nancy accidentally died. What are the odds? What do you think about the likelihood that this person did speak to anybody else or told anyone else about this in any way, shape, or form? Or is this something that maybe they're just operating as normal, back to their normal life, mm-hmm. and nobody knows except that one person? Is that a mm-hmm. possibility? Because so often we hear of leakage. Somebody said something to somebody, but again, that's not always the case.
Yeah, I don't think we have stats. You're right. But there certainly have been other cases, and sometimes high profile cases, where the person simply never told anyone. And I mentioned, I think when we were talking last week, about the Kristen Smart case in mm-hmm. California, happened back in the 90s. And 25 years later, a guy was arrested and successfully prosecuted for her murder, even though the body was never found. And no one ever talked. And Paul Flores is in prison now for the murder of Kristen Smart, even though no one has ever found her body. And Flores has never confessed anything to anyone. Mm-hmm. But he was convicted on circumstantial evidence discovered by a podcaster who kind of set the wheels in motion for a successful prosecution. But I don't think he's ever going to talk. I think the family is going to go to their graves, never knowing exactly what happened to their daughter or where her body is.
Yeah. And there are a lot of cases like that where yeah. there is no grand motivation. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes, you know, especially if it's a younger victim, a lot of times it can look as it's sexually motivated or something mm-hmm. of that nature. It doesn't appear to be the case here, but who knows?
Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. Who knows? But there are, I mean, look at like the Golden State Killer. Look, there's all sorts of ones that come out of the woodwork years later. It's like, oh God, they were responsible for this and that. And it was never, let's go make money. You know, it was never, right. you know, let me get a message across to somebody. Let me show Savannah, or let me, whatever, you know, insert motivation or insert some sort of sensibility that the rest of us are waiting for to explain this out, which will never really ever make sense. But sometimes there is no sensibility to it other than it's what that person wanted to do mm-hmm. at that moment in time. There was some sort of box that was checking for them of kidnapping somebody, of killing somebody, just the exercise of doing so with no other motivation other than the twisted joy that they're feeling doing such a crime. Does this lean into that area for you at all? When you look at this case, nothing taken, we don't have any messages, nothing at all. I mean, it does kind of feel like maybe this was pure, again, I'm not trying to be cold here, but just something pure joy for the monster that did this.
It is strange enough that, you know, it's hard to speculate. Mm-hmm. Could it have been somebody who had, you know, as you said, a sexual motive? Even in a woman of advanced age, those things have happened. And mm-hmm. as awful as it seems yeah. to be, it certainly could go in that direction. But I think the person was in a burglar getup, you know, so it wasn't, yeah. I mean, sometimes we see people murdered on the street for absolutely no reason other than it was a psychotic person, you know, mm-hmm. with a board who hit a whole lady on the street in Seattle. That happened a couple weeks ago. So you see weird things happen like that. But this was a person who obviously had done some planning, who came with what looked like preparation for burglary. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I keep going back to, that somebody maybe did not intend to run into her, and they did, and there was an unfortunate outcome, and this is where we're at right now.
Obviously, the search is ongoing. They're looking, you know, we've heard every which direction it could possibly go. People who do B&Es, it's usually not a one-off. It's not like, hey, today I'm going to go do a B&E, and that's the last time I'm ever going to do it. Just going to dip my toe in the pool and see how it is. It's a pattern. It's usually something, you know, they learned it from somebody, and then it's going to keep going for however long that benefits them, and that makes the most sense for their own modality. Is the best odds of finding who did this really keeping an eye out on B&Es and seeing if they go strike again? I mean, what do you think the odds are if whoever did this is going to be back out there doing B&Es and hoping for a better outcome where somebody doesn't accidentally die along the way? I'm wondering what or is this an event that may make them take pause and go, maybe I should do something else to get by?
It's sure the community I would be looking at, you mm-hmm. know, who has previous arrests for those kind of things. And I would guess that at this point, they're going to be very careful and maybe not do anything in the near future. But it would be, as you say, people are creatures of pattern, and it would be something that eventually they would go back to. And mm-hmm. so that's, yeah, if I worked in law enforcement, I would be looking at that.
How curious would you be to be looking at the communication, the incoming communication to Savannah Guthrie? And what I mean by this is, you know, she's a public figure on the Today Show. There's no way in hell she's reading all of her emails. There's somebody that's going through that and picking out the important ones. And there's the barrage of crazy that comes yeah. with that sort of a position. You know, everything from saying, I love you, thank you for the, you know, the tips on how to make a delicious broccoli salad, to you're not listening to me. Why aren't you listening to me? You know, those sort of folks, they get upset when they don't get the communication back. Might that be an area, if they're not already, I would certainly think they are, but God knows. Might that be an area that would be interesting to explore for something like this, where it could be something that's done out of spite? Or are we getting too much into the world of where this would be the made-for-TV version of this horror story?
I would definitely be looking at that. Everybody who has sent her things, you know, I've even gotten things in the mail, weird letters about how to find God or whatever. Somebody sure. sees me on a show and it's like, here's a message for you from God.
Yes.
Okay. So
and my dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would imagine she has, as all television personalities get stuff like that, I would imagine that she has gotten a lot over the years from people who like her and people who don't like her. And so I would certainly be going through every bit of that and looking at it really closely.
It's got to be absolute hell. I mean, words can't describe. I cannot imagine the purgatory that the Guthrie family are dealing with right now. The not knowing, the watching, the clusterness of this investigation in every step of the way that it's been, where we're sitting right now, where it really, hopefully I'm wrong, and hopefully they do get somebody and something changes here. But the way it's looking right now is that this is slowly or quickly slipping into cold case territory. What would you say to that family as they try and not move on, but continue to move forward in their lives with this burden that is now attached to them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's clear they're getting lots of support, and we wish them the best with all of that. But there's just not any, we always use the word closure, right? This is particularly bad. Does closure ever really happen in a situation where there's a violent crime or some kind of mysterious death? No, but particularly here where you don't even know what happened and you don't really know, is she dead or is she still with us? It's just incredibly hard for them. And I think just the kind of you know, the way they express their faith. I know Savannah is very religious. Leaning on your faith community and being surrounded with people who love you and care about you, but it requires a lot of emotional resiliency to move forward and pick up life and go on without ever really knowing. It's just super hard. You have to hold those two realities at the same time of holding hope. It could be, she could be alive, but then sitting with the increasingly dark possibility that she's not.
And it sounds like in their, at least the message that Savannah recently put out, that they seem to have come to that realization or acceptance that she might not be around anymore.
Yeah.
That whatever happened is incredibly heartbreaking. Your thoughts in the comments section. We'd love to hear them. Your thoughts on Substack or YouTube. The links are in the descriptions. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening so you don't miss any of our coverage on this case. Let's move over to another conversation and another case that we are closely following right here. Corey Richens. We're going to be stepping inside the psychology of this case, the psychology of partners who allegedly choose murder over divorce, using the Corey Richens case as our lens, assuming the prosecution's theory is accurate. Corey, obviously innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. That's what the trial is for. So allegedly in front of anything we say here, we're exploring what makes someone believe killing their spouse is the better option than filing some paperwork. What's the internal logic? How did they justify it to themselves? Siobhan Scott is a licensed psychotherapist, over 30 years working with both victims and perpetrators of violence, and the author of The Mind of Mass Killers and your memoir, which is right here, out now. Nightbird, available wherever books are sold. I need the Price is Right music when we do that. I've been watching so much Price is Right lately. The Bob Barker years, the old ones, as an escape from the world. And I'm really, every now and then I walk around my house, I'm like, what do we got behind the fridge for dinner? It's a brand new lasagna. You know, then I play the music and everybody in my house stares at me. But hey, you gotta find happiness somewhere.
That's why you're popular. We all love those moments. Yeah.
A new lasagna. Siobhan, let's start with the fundamental question this case raises. Obviously, divorce exists. Separation exists. Walking away exists. For someone who allegedly chose murder instead, what's the internal logic going on here? How does killing a spouse become a better option in their mind?
It's really strange, isn't it? For those of us who have had to leave relationships, it's like this doesn't look like the easiest path. No. But I think what's the story in this case is the big financial situation, is that walking away, she would not have walked away with the money. Mm-hmm. And by eliminating him, by Eric's death, she would come out with this incredible level of status and this lifestyle that she would just not have otherwise. And apparently that's enough for some people.
It's a lifestyle she had. The problem with it is it didn't involve her boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't know. It's like, you're going to do all this. You're going to take, I mean, it on paper, sure. I mean, if we're just looking at this, okay, you know, X plus Y equals Z or whatever. And yes, you kill that person, you get their money. You can go have your relationship over here. This is all assuming no one figures out, you know, that you did it. But then that happens and then, oh, all bets are off. It's rather narrow-minded thinking, or very much with the blinders on of, I guess, you know, focusing on the goal, but not seeing everything around you that could easily take you down. How are they not seeing the other aspects of this, of possibly being caught or feeling any emotion about what the hell they're talking about doing?
The word that kept coming to mind as I was watching a lot of the trial footage and trying to put the pieces of this together is the word fantasy. Someone that's got this image of what life is supposed to be like, and they really are very fantasy driven. So the fantasy perfect lover, a lot of the texts that were written had this very, you know, kind of overdone dramatic quality that made me think of this as somebody that thinks they're living out a movie. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you're going to just easily eliminate your husband and end up with all the cash and this, you know, real estate business and everything else you're going to get. And then you're going to have this perfect lover and this perfect life. It just sounded very, to me, sort of like a kid, childish driven fantasy thinking. It didn't sound very, you know, the plausible as far as seeing that this would be something that would actually work.
Living in a movie is a really interesting way of putting it. You know, where everything is scripted and everybody is an actor in their show, in their play. Everyone's a pawn to them.
Yes.
And that's an interest. And it seems, I mean, there's a lot of people who do seem to think that way. And there's terms for that sort of thing. Obviously, we can't diagnose Corey Richens here, and when she never has publicly. But if we were to just glean some guesses based on her behavior, based on what is publicly known about it, the words that come to my mind, borderline, narcissistic personality disorder, things of that nature, would you glean that maybe she's, I know you can't diagnose either, we're not doing that, but would you glean that that might be the direction of how that brain might be functioning?
It sure could be. Somebody that idealizes certain people and devalues other people, who tends to use people as pawns in their story. When they're convenient, you want them there. When they're not convenient, you find a way to eliminate them. Somebody who has a high degree of drama going on, a lot of intensity, a lot of wheeling, dealing. And then, of course, you've got someone who's very status conscious, which is another reason sometimes people would prefer to be a widow rather than a divorced wife, because you look better in your community or in your religious group or whatever if you're a widow.
And image did seem to be a pretty big thing to Corey, wanting to come across as a successful real estate home flipper. I mean, it seems like someone who watched a bit too much HGTV with a personality disorder. This is the equation. This is what you get. It's not fun. You spend a ton of money on the hobby, if you will. And what comes across on the outside to other people is, wow, look how ambitious she is. Look at all the things she's doing. They're not seeing the actual bank statements or how things aren't working out whatsoever, or the chaos is going on inside that relationship, because they're able to really project a totally different image, a facade to the outside world. It's like, I mean, it's Instagram, basically. Everybody sees the Instagram, and that's all they see. They're not seeing what's going on behind the curtain.
Yeah, very much. Yeah. And this kind of intense drive to create this persona, this image of success, it's got a strange quality to it. Another aspect of it, especially as you say, when you're looking at what was really behind the numbers, it's got a strange, fishy quality. I can see why this case got looked at again, because there seemed to be red flags everywhere.
Yeah, we'll get into some of those numbers in a little bit. I mean, it's striking just how much was siphoned out of her husband financially without him knowing. But I get it. It can happen. Been there, done that. Prosecutors allege Corey, and this is interesting, told someone that she felt stuck and that she felt trapped in her marriage. And it'd be better if Eric was dead, basically, allegedly. I find this really interesting. Because if you're looking at it from the perspective of Eric, that's how he felt. Eric was essentially the hostage in this relationship. He was there because he cared for those three kids, and he didn't trust Corey to be the sole caretaker, 50-50 or in her own time. So he was there. He was being that buffer. He was being the protector of those kids. He had no choice of what to do other than protect them. At least that's how he was feeling in this relationship. So for Corey to be going around and projecting that image that she's the one who's stuck, she's the one who's trapped, all the while he's funding all of her shit, and she's taking and she's stealing and she's cheating, who's really stuck and trapped here? It's an interesting way to express yourself to the outside world.
Yeah. And again, seeing herself in that light makes it sound like she's the victim here.
Yes.
Which clearly, when you look at all the objective evidence, that's That's not how it looks, not what was going on. Yeah.
No, it's just interesting how a personality like this will sometimes grab onto what. Do you think she's grabbing onto what she knew Eric was feeling, or what she was observing Eric maybe even saying? I mean, Eric was telling his family and friends, something happens to me, Corey did it. That's someone who's trapped, who's not like running out the door, rather than he's warning people like, I gotta, you know, bide my time here. If something happens, it's her. But she's out there spinning the narrative. Can we talk about that a little bit, about just how folks like this do dive in and spin the narrative, and then they make people think almost the opposite of what reality really is?
It kind of goes back to that tendency also, that when I'm doing something that could be considered bad, right? Whatever value judgment you want to put on it, I'm doing something that's not okay, but it's the fault of other persons, other people, or this other person, the person I'm married to. I'm having to do this because of them. And so it's like this flip from, I'm making choices here, I'm responsible for my life, and I'm taking responsibility for what I'm doing, owning it, versus, well, I'm keeping this positive view of myself because I'm only doing this because they're making me do it. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of a distorted way of perceiving the world. But you do see that sometimes with people who commit crimes. It's like, I had to do it because you didn't give me a choice.
Do they not see the choice? Do they not see their own autonomy when they're in a situation like that? I mean, it's strange that one would think that, number one, killing them is even a lever to pull. But the fact that it's so easy to get there, and they're not, I mean, you almost have to believe your own shit to kind of go down that road, don't you?
Yeah. And I think if we got into, you know, the criminal mind, having that tendency to not accept responsibility for your own choices, and seeing that it's other people who make you do the bad things because you aren't given any other choice, that's probably the core of the criminal mind. And I've always told you this story, but I'll mention it again. The very first client I ever had back in 1987 in a clinical role was the heroin addict who had grabbed the old lady's purse and took off running with it and knocked her down, broke her shoulder. And his explanation to me, why did this happen? What was going on with you? Well, I didn't do anything to her. I needed the purse. I needed the money, and she wouldn't let go of it. So really, it's on her that she didn't let go of the purse. And he meant it. He truly meant it. That was his way of perceiving in the world, you know. And so I think when you see people sometimes who do these outrageous things, it's like they have convinced themselves that I'm not responsible. You know, I've got limited options here, and it's the other person's fault that I have to do it this way.
The world put me in this position. I don't have a choice. How do you handle that as a psychotherapist? I mean, how can, is there any walking that back? Is there any, like, let's take a step over here and take a look at what this really looks like, what you just told me, and how that plays in the real world with other people? Are they capable of seeing it from that perspective? What do you do?
That's the goal. That's the goal of treatment, right? Is to get people to start to see reality the way the rest of the world sees it, which is that you are responsible for the choices you make. And if you got yourself into an unhappy marriage, here are the legitimate ways you can get yourself out of that. But certainly poisoning your spouse is not one of those accepted ways. Yeah.
Are some people incapable of looking at it from any other way other than that sort of a prism, where it's just, it's so dire? And I mean, when you get to have that conversation, like, no, there are other ways of doing this. Look at this. Here's the possibilities.
Yeah.
Is it just brick wall? No. I mean, it's because they just can't get there for whatever reason. It's just, you're wrong, and that's just immediately dismissed, and no one can reach that type of brain. I mean, can you get there? Could Corey's mind have been changed?
We like to think we can make a difference, don't we?
Yeah.
we sure try. We sure try and get people to look at options and choices and get to the bottom of what feels so uncomfortable about all these other more realistic options to you that you don't see that you have those choices. that would sure be the goal. But mm-hmm. are there people who are very resistant to taking responsibility for themselves and looking at, you know, I try to encourage everybody I work with to see that our lives are our responsibility and our responsibilities alone. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of times people, as we always do in therapy, we look back at the family history and how did you become the person that you are. And a lot of times people will cite abusive family backgrounds and, you know, difficult things they went through. And that's all relevant mm-hmm. to how you became the person you are. But moving forward, you take responsibility for yourself and you're creating your life. And that is very something that a lot of people have a hard time doing.
Prosecutors are alleging that there were multiple poisoning attempts, at least one other, where she laced a sandwich with something, put it on his seat of his truck while he was working. And here you go, honey. Happy Valentine's Day. I love you. He broke out into hives allegedly right away. Might have used an EpiPen. Laid down for a couple of hours, thought he might have to go to the hospital. He survived that one. And after she dropped it off, she's texting her boyfriend, love you, I just dropped you. And then a couple of days later, or a handful of days later, he's dead because the second attempt actually worked. What are the odds you think that there was only the two attempts here, or the one attempt that failed and then the actual one? With someone like this, with people who chose poisoning as the modality for their plan, is it usually that quick? Do they usually get it on the first one or two tries, or do you think this is something where maybe if we were really able to look into areas that we're not able to look into, pure speculation in this world, do you think there might have been more attempts or other things that we're unaware of in that dynamic of a relationship of her trying to harm her husband?
That would make an interesting movie script, wouldn't it? Unfaithful wife trying to poison the husband, and you see all these failed attempts and all these times that she tried and it didn't work, and she just kept getting better and better at it. Anybody's guess. I don't know that we have data on poisonings and how many unsuccessful attempts, you know, that were never revealed. But I sure hope that people pay attention to this case and dissuade themselves out of that plan. It's like, it's, you know, definitely not worth it.
I mean, it's interesting. What was it? DHS, somebody the other day issued a statement about an uptick in spousal poisonings. I don't have that in front of me at this second, but it was like an official like statement out of nowhere about this being a thing that people should be far more aware of than they actually are. Are we seeing more of this going on, or are we just finally detecting more of it going on?
Right. I'll have to research it more and see what can we find out about uptick in poisoning, spousal poisonings, because that's really alarming. And my guess is that there have always been a lot of this stuff happening that was never identified. You know, it was just never looked at as what had caused it. So,
and then toxicology caught up. And suddenly it's not such an easy one to do anymore. Wouldn't that be an interesting question though, to ask someone who is away, who has admitted to their own guilt of poisoning? How many times did you attempt this beforehand? Like, it would, you know, that would be a great question from prison. If there's someone who's like, yeah, I'll bear it all, let me help you out. That would be very, that would be very revealing, because it would tell us a lot more about the ones who are still actively being accused or not gotten caught yet or whatever, as to that sort of modality. After Eric's death, Corey wrote the children's book about grief. She appeared on television as a grieving mom, publicly performed the widowhood. It was a very interesting, you know, performance. She's out there and she's got the book. How does someone compartmentalize at that level where, okay, if she did it, let's assume she did, you got away with it. Now you're writing a freaking book about it. Like this is like, bring more. If you got away with it, consider yourself lucky. Consider yourself a lucky duck. Go on with your boyfriend and your money and your kids and do whatever you're going to do. You're writing a book. This is going to bring more attention back to you. Does that just speak to the ego, to the narcissism, to the personality like this, where they they're just so blissfully unaware of how others could possibly perceive them.
I think you're right. And that desire to always have this image about, look, what a wonderful person I am. Look, what a wonderful parent I am. I'm a wonderful mom. And to be thought of well in your community, to have people having sympathy for you. I mean, all those things would be motivators. But yeah, ego, you use the word ego, what a big ego. And then as well as the ability to compartmentalize and really believe that, well, I may have done this other thing that, you know, I wasn't really supposed to do, but I was justified. I had my reasons. I was trapped. I had to do it. But look at me. I'm a wonderful person. So,
yeah. Department of Homeland Security, it was DHS, is the one that warned that domestic partners are increasingly using toxins like fentanyl because they mimic natural illness, complicating detection in an overdose epidemic. A fentanyl death doesn't raise red flags. Another thought on this, honestly, too, which is kind of, I think, the area that they're going down in this case is, well, you know, fentanyl is in a lot of street drugs, even when it's not what you bought. And it's killing people everywhere. It is. I mean, this is not. There's this, I guess, risk that DHS thought important enough to put a memo out about. But then there's also the very big reality that it's someone who is using street drugs, whether it be Oxy or whatever, of dying of getting a fentanyl overdose when you're not even realizing it. That, I guess, could also open up the door and the window to more situations where it's a unhappy relationship, it's fractured, it's not working out well, somebody's cheating, whatever, and then one partner dies. And if they're taking illicit drugs, that could easily look like somebody tried to poison the other person. So it kind of works on both ends. It's like, number one, be careful. But number two, be even more careful if you're in a rough relationship and your partner's using street drugs, because they might, you might just get murder pinned on you.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly could go that way. And we wonder if this had been a different family and a different income level, different part of the country, might this have never been tagged as problematic?
That's true. Yeah, there's so many questions. Your thoughts on Corey Richens and her modalities of functioning and everything we've been talking about here. Let us know in the comment section on YouTube and on our Substack. The links are in the description, and be sure to press subscribe. Talking about Corey Richens here, and I want to talk about things more from the perspective of Eric shifting from his world as the victim. Eric Richens allegedly told multiple people he believed his wife was trying to poison him. He reportedly consulted divorce and estate planning lawyers, removed her from his life insurance, and yet stayed in the marriage. What is it like to suspect the person you love, the parent of your children, might be capable of killing you? How does that confusion and denial play out? And what should others recognize if someone they know might be in this situation? If you might be in this situation watching this right now going, this seems really familiar to me. Listen up. Siobhan Scott is with us, psychotherapist and author, to help us break this down. Siobhan, Eric, he told close friends, I think my wife tried to poison me. If something happens to me, look at her. He reportedly told his sister about a suspected poisoning attempt years. Oh, there we go. Well, there's your answer to the question I had before. Was there other attempts? Allegedly there was, in Greece years earlier. Yet he stayed. How does someone hold both of those realities at once? Suspicion that their spouse might be actively trying to kill them and continuing to live with that person and publicly perform what looks like a marriage, perform what looks like love.
Yeah. Denial, you use the word, and how to toggle back and forth between fear and denial and worry and what's reality and when are you getting paranoid? I mean, it sounds like something that would be a very big burden to be living with. And of course, I mean, I would like to think that anybody who may be listening, look, if you think that your spouse or partner is trying to poison you, this is probably a relationship you should not be in, number one, rather than how do you keep yourself safe? That's just impossible for me to imagine living with someone that I seriously thought was capable of poisoning me. But these things obviously do happen. If it happened here, it can happen again. So that tendency to, on some level, have reality breakthrough, but then be able to change the lens of the glasses and not see it. People really are good at that. And who knows how long he had lived with this sense that something was that off, that he really wasn't safe.
What I want to get your thoughts on this, because there's a lot of lenses that, you know, obviously we can't be Eric, so we don't know exactly what lens he was looking at it through. But I mean, there's something incomprehensible about suspecting your partner is trying to murder you. It's not like suspecting infidelity or financial deception. I mean, he already had seen those. It's more existential here. He was seemingly aware that this is a reality. It could happen to him. I don't know that Eric was sitting there thinking, it can't happen to me. This only happens on Lifetime movies. I think he knew it was a very real threat, but his reasoning for staying wasn't, it can't happen to me. It's, I got three kids. If she's capable of doing this to me, what's she capable of doing to those kids? Mm-hmm. And she knows the biggest thing in the world that would hurt me more than anything else, more than hurting me, more than, you know, killing me, would be hurting those kids. And if she's that callous and capable, I think is might be the right word, if she's that capable of doing this to me, she could be capable of doing it to the kids. What do you say to someone who is in that situation right now?
Got to find a good lawyer, really, as soon as possible. Yeah. And figure out, how do I separate myself from this person safely? And, you know, of course, just those practical things. I wouldn't have this person preparing my food. I wouldn't want them preparing the kids' food. I mean, if you really don't think your kids are safe, you've got to take legal action to get a restraining order and get whatever evidence a judge is going to need, you know, and that can vary depending on the community, but you've got to protect yourself and get away from someone like this.
You almost have to roll the dice because not rolling them is more dangerous if you truly feel yourself being in that situation. Because regardless of whether, I mean, you're essentially saying to yourself that I'm going to be smart enough, good enough, and gosh darn it, people, I had to go down that road, that you're going to be smart enough to catch it, that you're going to, that you are going to be aware enough of this person's actions that you're going to catch them before they do whatever they're going to do. And knowing that that's already very much a real possibility, or maybe already an attempt that's been made, you might not catch it when the kids start choking or the kids start keeling over and then you start feeling shitty later. Yeah. That you are still living in that reality where that could take place, and rolling the dice to get out of there. And it is rolling the dice, because I think that's the big thing people go to is, in a court of law, if you don't have the evidence, you can't just go into court and say, I think she tried to kill me in Greece a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. I got no evidence for it. And then she's like, this is crazy. Of course I wouldn't do that. 50-50 custody. Thank you. Have a good day. Mm-hmm. That's how that would go down. And that's why people are like, I'm not going to roll those dice. I'm going to hedge my bets over here. But that really, truly is not a very good bet to make.
No. I would encourage people to get as many resources as they can, to talk to as many people as they can, let people know what's going on, keep track of everything, keep logs about everything. And yeah, you hate to have a messy situation in court with custody battles and all of that, of course, best avoided. But if people are truly in danger, if you feel that your kids are potentially endangered by their other parent or whatever, I mean, those awful things do happen, and you've got to try everything you can possibly try legally.
And he did. He consulted lawyers. He changed his will. He removed Corey from his life insurance policy as a beneficiary, transferred business assets to a trust controlled by his sister, but he didn't leave. That's the one thing he did not do. Yeah. I mean, and I think it hindsight can be 20/20. If you're doing those sort of things and you're in the relationship, you got to get the hell out of that. That like, if you're checking all those boxes, the fire has reached the top floor. It's mm-hmm. it's time to get out. Mm-hmm. It's no longer just, hey, there's the hedge down there is burning. Let's call the fire. It's like, no, it's the towering inferno. Yeah. It's about to end. So either you get on that helicopter and get out now, or you're not getting out.
100%.
For victims in this situation, there's often no one to tell who would believe them. You know, I think my wife is poisoning me. It sounds paranoid. It sounds delusional sometimes. Let's talk about that isolation. How does isolation of an unbelievable suspicion keep victims like this trapped?
It's a hard one, right? Because you're right. If you're too loud, people may think you're just crazy. But if you don't get support and you don't talk to people, you may be dead. And so it's one of those things, I think, even for a man in a situation like this, I would still contact the domestic violence hotline for support. You know, mm-hmm. we think that that's always for women. It's not. Men can be victims too. And certainly if you're living in fear, it doesn't matter if you've ever been hit or not, you know, but there are all kinds of ways that a person can be terrorized in a relationship and feel unsafe. And so I would definitely reach out to domestic violence resources.
What would you say to someone out there or someone who, you know, might be watching this going, I don't know, because there's a lot of people that I'm sure are on the edge that are going, maybe I'm just paranoid. You know, I don't know if they're maybe this is happening. I don't know. What sort of questions would you ask someone to help them try and hone in of, either you're being paranoid, you watched too much Dateline, which does happen. Some people can go off on tangents in their mind and construct cognitive distortions that are not really happening around right. them. And then you have real things that are going on around you that are very hard to bear. What would you be asking someone to help them get a clearer picture of what truly is happening and ground them in their own reality?
Yeah, people can take off with paranoid thinking, certainly. But usually when it's based in reality, you have specifics, you have situations, you have things that came up, things that actually happened. And so I would have a person actually make a written list of these things that are real that happened. And if somebody is just dealing with paranoia, that's usually a lens that they're looking through, and they see danger everywhere. Mm-hmm. So they see that people in their workplace are conspiring against them. They may see a religious group is conspiring against them, or family members, or whatever. But if it was just honing in on a partner, I would help them look for the evidence. And has anything like this ever happened to you before? And just try and get a read on it. You know, now I'm wondering if this case is not going to spur a lot of people having paranoid thoughts when maybe there isn't something really going on. But I don't think there's any way through it other than looking at everything that happens and keeping a list and trying to look for, you know, either evidence in one direction or the other.
But I love them. But we had such a good time on the honeymoon. But we had this, but we had that. There's a lot of things that people will tell themselves of, well, maybe they can change. Mm-hmm. No, they can't. What would you say to someone? I mean, that's my take on it. But what would you say to someone who does have some evidence, who has some, truly has seen this? It's not just paranoia. And they haven't taken action, since they haven't pulled the trigger. I don't mean to say that, yeah. But they haven't changed their course of action. They haven't changed their path of what they're dealing with. They're still on that relationship path with that person. And they're thinking, oh, I'll give them a second chance. Their friends and family, their mom, their dad, whoever is saying, oh, but what about the kids? You should really give that a second chance. Someone that's demonstrating this in someone's life, ever give a second chance once there's an attempted poisoning once, or you think that they're capable of it, or there may be signs that they're looking at this idea for you? Is there ever a, they were misguided, let's make this work out?
No, I think you'd say no. I'd say no.
Yeah.
I think the number one need that we all have in a relationship is safety. I mean, you want to feel emotionally safe with your partner. You definitely want to feel physically safe with your partner. And if you don't have safety, I know you and I have both had those experiences in relationships in the past where we did not feel safe. And if you don't feel safe, this is probably not a relationship to waste any more time on. And you may need some support and help getting clear on that. But my gosh, you don't want to feel at risk from the person that you're sleeping next to every night.
Concern for safety should never be an element of a relationship, especially, I mean, any relationship, romantic relationship, even more so. People sometimes don't see that, though. They and I'm going to guess that might be because it was demonstrated to them at some point in time. I mean, does upbringing, does what people saw in their own parents or relationships around them that may not have been safe, but they survived, they got through it. How much does that influence people to stay in nightmares like this?
It has a lot to do with it. You know, the kind of things, this is where your background really is relevant to the person that you've developed into. And if you came from a background where there was not a sense of safety in the home or in the relationship between your family members, you may not have a very good radar for what's normal and what's not normal. And you may accept all kinds of things. And I know in my marriage with my angry husband, who's now deceased, I grew up in a home where there was a lot of anger expressed and a lot of yelling and things that now I know my nervous system responds poorly to that. I don't tolerate that. Yeah. That's not something I'm willing to live with. But when I was a young woman, I was willing to live with it. Mm-hmm. And we just don't always pick up on things that should be cues of danger, should be a red flag for us.
Just because something seems normal to you doesn't mean it's healthy.
That's right.
And that's a realization that usually takes some time and some reps in life to get to. Siobhan Scott, the book, Nightbird, in fact, the relationship you're just talking about, very well documented in here. Very, very good and interesting read. I highly suggest checking it out wherever you get books. As always, thank you so much for coming on and giving us your insight. Links to her Substack in our Substack. Go check it out. Hiddenkillers.substack.com. When you subscribe, you'll automatically be suggested to go check out Siobhan's Substack. So press subscribe and boom, there you go. Hiddenkillers.substack.com. Leave us your thoughts, your comments on that Substack or on our YouTube. Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi is where you find us. And be sure to hit subscribe wherever you're downloading or listening. Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Hit subscribe so you don't miss any of our conversations and reporting on these cases. All right. We'll continue the conversation in the comments. Until then, for Siobhan and Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.